Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. This is episode 15. Again, the topic is the science to be done on the early Artemis missions. Before we start, let's explain a few terms that you will hear. HEO is NASA's Human Exploration and Operations Office. ISRU means In Situ Resource Utilization. Viper is a rover which will explore the South Pole of the Moon looking for those resources. And PSR is a permanently shadowed region, one of which will be explored by Viper. Julie Robinson is chief scientist and in August of 2021 was acting manager of the Human Exploration and Operations Office at NASA headquarters in Washington. First, you gave an overview of the talk.
So in my presentation today, I'm going to go over very briefly four main topics. First, what is our Artemis strategy and plan for human exploration? Then what's the strategic value or how does physical science fit in that strategy? And what overall capabilities for physical sciences might come from the architecture? And then finally, how HEO is working with STMD and SMD jointly to ensure that those capabilities are available as the lunar architecture develops. And as you might expect, that's going to be a process, not a single event.
Then she went on to explain the first landing.
So first of all, our first mission to land on the moon, even though that's something we did decades ago, we are doing it with all new systems and a huge amount of additional knowledge about how to best support the human body in space missions. So what you'll see first, of course, is we have precursor missions that the Science Mission Directorate's doing. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is giving us all kinds of information about the ground, the early South Pole robotic landings, Viper coming in. What's going to happen for the human missions is we'll have Artemis, which is our Artemis 1, which will be our first time to send a human spacecraft to the moon in the 21st century, but that will be uncrewed. Then Artemis 2 will have crew on board, but they will not land. They'll go into the near rectilinear halo orbit, which is the first time we'll have used that orbit in human spaceflight. Then along the way, we'll get to Artemis 3, which is our deep space, first deep space crewed mission, our first lunar landing of two crew members on the surface. And the Gateway will begin its development and operations with the launch of the power and propulsion element and the HALO, or the habitation and logistics element. Gateway is very small. I think of it almost like a changing room. It lets us make different components reusable in orbit over the longer term of the architecture. So after we get those first missions under our belt, we move to the buildup of the Artemis Base Camp. And this is our approach to a sustainable presence on lunar orbit in the same way that we want a sustainable presence in low Earth orbit. So we want a sustainable presence in lunar orbit and on the surface. So we expect to gradually have a buildup of different components that support the crew, such as the lunar terrain vehicle to allow them more mobility to get to more science sites of interest. Then eventually, as we have more and more crew landers, we'll have a pressurized rover. On the technology side, there'll be a fission surface power plant as well as an ISRU pilot plant that are deployed. And then finally, we get to a surface habitat so that we can finally have four crew members live and work on the surface.
She compared the mobility available on the moon as against on Mars.
One important thing to think about from a human exploration perspective is in what ways is the lunar surface and the Mars surface, are they analogs for each other? Because much of what we're doing in our architecture is aimed at having multi-purpose facilities. So as we test a mobility platform for the crew on the lunar surface, we want that to teach us and to establish the parameters for a mobility platform that would be used on the surface of Mars. So in these environments, we have the same altered gravity, but of course it's 1/6 Earth gravity on the lunar surface, 3/8 on the Mars surface. Radiation is similar with both galactic cosmic rays and then solar particle events, which you can shield for. In a hostile closed environment perspective, we're in a different atmosphere. We're expecting to use an exploration atmosphere with a lower total pressure and enriched oxygen compared to what we're doing on ISS today. Also, those environments have dust, although the lunar dust and Mars dust are quite different. From a distance from Earth perspective, on the moon, we still have relatively fast communications and a return maybe 2 to 3 days, but practically from near halo orbit, closer to a week to return from the surface. So we can come home if we have problems better than a Mars mission where we really have to do the full round trip and it could be 9 months return. We also don't have the comm delay. So that makes the moon a perfect place to test technologies and autonomy for Mars forward exploration purposes. And then finally, from an isolation and confinement perspective, we're dealing with missions and we can design our missions to be very predictive of what it would be like for the crew to live and work on the Mars surface. And so just to kind of summarize the matches, the similarities and the differences, you know, you've got a similarity in gravity, it's close for partial gravity, you've also got a microgravity opportunity, you've got a match for the environment, you've got a match for radiation as deep space radiation, depending on your duration. The early short missions, even though it's deep space radiation, may not have that significant a radiation exposure. You've got a match for isolation and confinement, depending on the duration, but you're less connected in a Mars mission than you would be in this lunar mission. So that lets you test new systems.
She also raised the issue of mission phase analogs.
So we can also think of early mission operations with very limited resources and support as analogs for the first Mars landing. Over time, we'll extend the duration and the infrastructure till we get to longer missions on the surface. But we can also do combination missions with the crew staying at the gateway, especially in something called the transit habitat, which would both be tested at the gateway and then turn around, put on a propulsion module, and used as the crew habitat for the transit to Mars. And so we have the ability to do some combination test missions before we make that first Mars transit and prove out that surface, that transit habitat, which is a really important opportunity in the architecture.
And Julia Robinson went on to discuss how to prepare for Mars.
So overall, these lunar missions prepare us for Mars in many ways. In orbit, we have deep space aggregation, we have the Mars transit habitat, orbit to surface operations, commercial resupply and refueling, which is particularly important, and using it as a crew health and performance analog. On the surface, we're testing our spacesuit advancements, our mobile operations and approaches, planetary protection needs, how to work between humans and robots and seamlessly combine those together to optimize science return. And we're learning how humans are resilient as they work and live in these challenging environments. So as much as possible, our lunar systems are designed for dual Moon-Mars operations.
She advocated a cross-platform strategy between the International Space Station and the Moon.
One of the things we tried to envision is how do you think about cross-platform research strategy? Because for the first time in history, we will have both a low Earth orbit platform as well as lunar platforms operating at the same time. That offers really significant cross-platform opportunities for things like dust mitigation, where you can study microgravity, but then you can study partial gravity environments. For cryogenic storage, chill down and tank transfer is another really important area with the ability to do, say, fluids transfers on ISS to understand how you would load vehicles before with liquid propellant before they would go to Mars, then the ability to look at landers and surface storage of cryo and do that on the lunar surface, predictive for the way that those materials would behave on Mars. Flammability is really interesting because not only do you have the microgravity combustion differences with Earth combustion, but also the fact that we'll be in an enriched oxygen environment compared to what we've been used to operating in on the ISS. And so having combustion models that can both look at atmosphere as well as partial gravity, that's a really important area that has not been well investigated in the past. But it may be that drop towers are the most efficient way to get a large amount of data early on.
Of course, we need to know about the regolith, that is the soil of the moon, and how materials will perform on the moon.
In the area of regolith extraction and solidification, really understanding and demonstrating how you do that and pairing that with the science observations of what actually is in these minerals, how much water is there, would you extract it, and so forth is an important line of research. And then materials performance in general, how materials are performing in deep space radiation, thermal, and dusty environments. And all of those things are very enabled by measurements such as dust samples or regolith samples that will come from the science side of the house. And so combining these or working with planetary sciences and working with space technology is a really important way to make some of these advances have the most relevance.
She had this idea on supporting the first mission to Mars.
And similarly, our crew health and performance system itself rolls many of these together into engineering systems that are designed to keep the crew healthy, to mention that these things all come together in systems that will support the crew on that first mission to Mars.
On the Artemis flight, the first one to the moon, there will be two astronauts.
So the first crewed landing, it's going to be the crew members living in the landing system cabin for 6.5 days on the lunar surface. They'll do up to 4 moonwalks. They'll deploy instruments. They'll collect a variety of geologic samples to return to Earth for later research. And they will capture the real-time human response measures and environmental characterizations that help us start understanding how this environment affects the crew. And they'll do that with a limited and shared sample up mass and down mass.
The Gateway is a space station which will orbit the moon, and there's going to be some early science payloads aboard that.
There are some early Gateway science payloads that will be on the small beginnings of the Gateway. IRSA is a European Space Agency radiation instrument package, takes advantage of the Gateway's unique NRHO orbit. Hermes is a NASA space weather instrument to observe solar particles and solar wind. And then ESA will have an internal dosimeter array inside the HALO that will include instruments provided by the Japanese Space Agency.
Of course, the big ticket item is the human landing system that will take two astronauts down to the moon.
And then the human landing system is a brand new commercial procurement of a lander for the moon to help us accomplish all of these things over time. It will carry the crew to the lunar surface and return them to lunar orbit. Then Orion will bring them back home from there. It serves as the habitat on the lunar surface for the early missions until we get a habitat element on the surface. And it will house equipment for the surface activities, including things they need for the moonwalks, the sample collection, and scientific experiments. That landing system, you may have seen, has been in the news because we've been procuring that initial human landing system for a no earlier than 2024 launch date. And we've been through that announcement in the 2020s in spite of the pandemic. In July of 2021, we did a selection of our HLS provider, our Option A contract award, and that was announced to be SpaceX. Blue Origin, one of the competitors, has the protests have been resolved now, but they did file with the Court of Federal Claims just this week on August 13th, or just last week. So there are still procurement challenges going on there, but even so, we're moving forward on implementing and having that HLS lander as soon as we possibly can. At the same time, we're getting ready to go out with something called the Lunar Exploration Transportation Services contract. That's called LETS. The RFI went out on the street in July of 2021. And what this will do is procure the future landers. So this first lander is just the just one. NASA would love to have it be one of many, and NASA be one of multiple customers for these landers. That helps enable a broader economic ecosystem on the moon.
Eventually, a base camp will be set up.
The Artemis Base Camp is a huge enabler because this is where science, human exploration operations, and space technology can all come together. This is where we can prove out our EVA suits, our approaches to mobility, our the ways that we would live and work on the surface of a planetary body, whether that's the moon or Mars, power systems, communication systems, navigation systems, and how we would use resources to extend and expand that human presence and that infrastructure overall. So the Artemis Base Camp is really important for that goal of sustained lunar presence. That is one of the American strategic goals for Artemis and our return to the moon.
And she has ideas on how to utilize the resources on the moon.
So how do we work together between HEO, SMD, and STMD? Well, we track the goals and objectives of all three mission directorates, and we keep those that are applicable to human missions in a plan that we're developing right now. I wanted to share with you some of the cornerstone capabilities for utilization that we're developing, because these are the equivalent of facilities, if you will, from the ISS system. These are the things that the architecture components need to work together to enable for us to do some of the best science. So some of those things that we're working on are access to and operations in new terrain. These are our traverse use cases that help inform our crew and rover mobility and our communications. We're working on sampling, curation, and transport strategy. Orion is very limited, and we know we need more than that over the long term. So we need to define requirements for core tube samples, stratigraphy, identifying, collecting rocks, what we'll do with how we'll handle biological samples, cold sample curation, documentation tools, and the entire system for how we would use all of these different elements to bring samples home. Planetary protection strategy and microbial monitoring is another area. Extended duration orbit and surface missions for experiments and technology development, and that includes both ISS and Artemis. Integrating and coordinating access to human test subjects pre and post-flight, the uncrewed and robotic rover operations for utilization. So just because the LTV was put on the surface for human mobility doesn't mean that the rest of the year it could not be used for science. So working out how we would define those requirements and how we would use the systems together to optimize return and to optimize the science value. The instrumentation and measurements that we'd make on the surface, and how we would do complex operations in permanently shadowed terrain and cold regions. So the PSRs are one of the reasons that we're going to the South Pole, because that's where it's likely that permanently frozen water, ice, or CO2 or other components would be available. Those are also incredibly cold places to operate, and we don't know a lot about them yet. Viper will be an important precursor mission. We don't even know for sure in some of these areas if we could safely drill at those temperatures and collect a sample without releasing the volatiles. So there's a lot of work to be done there for enabling the overall utilization.
And of course, there's a debate going on whether there should be a base camp versus a full-out lunar base.
So I think it's really important to separate the base camp from a settlement. So the base camp is a place that you could go for up to 30 or maybe 60 days, but having people live on the moon permanently for year after year, like they have done on ISS, is much further out there in the architecture because, you know, this is a very challenging place to live. We have a lot to learn from shorter missions in the same way that we needed a lot of shuttle missions to learn about 2 week to 30 day responses to microgravity before we could have crew members live on ISS for 4 months. And then we got it to 6 months. And now we've had a handful of people at 12 months. So there definitely needs to be a buildup, both of the infrastructure as well as the knowledge before you get to a permanent settlement. But the Artemis Base Camp itself, we expect to have that coming in as early as possible in the architecture. That depends on a lot of things. For example, even though we're awarding an HLS contractor for the first landing, they don't actually have that spacecraft built yet. So there are going to be a number of things that affect that final manifest schedule. But certainly, By the end of the 2020s, we're hoping that we would have start having at least components of that base camp infrastructure on the surface.
Well, that was NASA Chief Scientist Julie Robinson speaking in August of 2021. In May of 2022, Jacob Blecher had this update on Artemis. As chief exploration scientist, he set out the state of play on human exploration, utilization, and planning.
And I'll talk a little bit today about how we're doing the utilization planning for human exploration. Utilization, just to define that here, what that word means is basically, how do we use the architecture we're developing in order to meet the objectives that the agency has? So again, we're going to the moon, okay? We're going to the south pole of the moon. And so to really figure out how to develop an architecture and how to build the elements that we want, we have to start with kind of why are we going? What is it that we want to do at the moon? And so we've heard a little bit sprinkled in about some of the objectives that we would hope to address. This is the important information that we pull in order to figure out how to build that architecture. And of course, there are science objectives. There's also technology objectives. In addition to the research about the moon, about the space environment, we also are trying to learn about the environment that our astronauts will be exposed to, as well as our hardware. We're trying to understand the hazards of human spaceflight. This is critical for us to move beyond low Earth orbit, not only to just go to the moon and come home, but to spend more and more time on the moon, explore more of the moon, and eventually take those next steps to explore the rest of the solar system as well. So it's these objectives that help us decide how to build an architecture. Again, the purpose here is to identify how our human exploration missions will support science, technology communities, as they try to meet their objectives. Now, some of those objectives are not something that is easily met in a single mission, single landing. Another way to say that is it's not all something that can be met within a single program. So it's not the human landing system program that needs to meet those high-level objectives. It's not the lunar terrain vehicle that needs to meet them. These are objectives that trace across multiple programs within Artemis. And so we identified what we call cornerstone capabilities that enable multiple objectives to be met across multiple elements within the architecture. For instance, a good one here, end-to-end sample return, the second one. In order to get samples from the lunar surface, particularly cold samples, if you look at operating in cold and shadowed regions, you know, that's not something we've done before. So how do you go get a sample from a cold region and transport it through multiple systems back to Earth so that our science community can start working on them? Those are technologies we have to develop to enable this architecture to meet the goals we have. So we just talked about the objectives, how the stakeholder organizations bring those objectives forward. We document them at our directorate level documents. They then trace into requirements that feed down to the programs. So around that, you can build an architecture to go out and meet those objectives. So here is kind of the notional plan of elements and programs that we have in mind. The SLS and the Orion are already developed, and we're getting ready for the integrated test flight in Artemis 1. Human landing system first contract was agreed to, and SpaceX is providing the first lander for the lunar surface. Gateway elements are already in development as we get ready to put the gateway in place. Obviously, ground systems and space communications and navigation. But we're also looking forward to putting out competitive calls for developing our surface mobility, the lunar terrain vehicle, and eventually ideas that are still in pre-formulation, you know, pressurized rovers or other forms of mobility so that we can make sure that our astronauts can get farther and farther out. We're very close to announcing the spacesuits that we're developing and how those will be applied in this new architecture. And eventually you look at all these elements together and they develop what we refer to as the Artemis Base Camp, or basically multiple elements in place in orbit and on the surface to support activities that meet those objectives. I think really important point is to note LRO. It's kind of been our guiding spacecraft for what we're doing now. That data that have come back from LRO over the past decade plus is critical for helping us plan where we're going globally with some of SMD's CLPS landings, as well as our human activities focused more in the South Polar region. So we're working towards that first flight, Artemis 1, coming up, that will eventually lead us to the third Artemis mission, which is the landing of crews in the South Pole. All throughout that swoosh, those hardware elements are opportunities for science. We work really hard between the directorates to identify places where opportunities will exist. And then SMD or STMD identify ways to engage the community and fund those activities to help meet the objectives. So Artemis 1 coming up, we have a number of secondary payloads. You know, this is just tremendous opportunity. We're studying the moon from this first Artemis launch through a number of CubeSats. We'll be studying the space environment. We'll be studying how to navigate in deep space. Just, you know, a wonderful opportunity to conduct research across multiple different themes as we move forward. There are also payloads on the inside. These are mostly focused on understanding how that environment within which we'll operate will be impacting our life, our crew, anything else that we're sending along with us as we explore the moon. So understanding, you know, bio-experiment one will help us understand the impact of the radiation environment on biology. How does that impact our crew specifically? With Gateway, we also have early identified payloads that will launch. Right at the beginning, Hermes, which is a NASA-provided payload that's understanding space weather. So basically using the Gateway as a platform to study that environment where we'll be sending our crew eventually. And so basically you could kind of think about this as Gateway is joining the heliophysics fleet for understanding that space environment and studying the sun. This also is in collaboration with ESA. So getting these data early from the spacecraft we're sending out before we send the crew will help us understand that radiation environment, going back to those objectives for understanding the hazards of spaceflight. All of this is leading up to the continued buildup, development of capabilities, development of hardware that will really start to push towards getting into the more detailed science objectives, research technology objectives that our agency has. You know, this is the vision we have, building up our assets on the surface so that we can conduct better and better research on the moon and explore more and more of the moon as we move forward. So with that, Deborah, I think I'm done. Thank you.
That was Jacob Bleacher. Elsewhere in NASA headquarters, Kevin Sato is Program Scientist for Exploration in the Biological and Physical Sciences Division. This is how he described the fundamental lunar science in April of 2021.
I'm going to be focusing on the Biological and Physical Sciences Division activities as it relates to lunar science. And we have been very focused over the last 20 plus years really on conducting experiments on Earth as well as in low Earth orbit in order to understand biological and physical systems responses to this environment. And so heading out beyond LEO and towards the moon is really a new era and entity for us. And so we're really interested in making sure that our objectives for this area of research are well defined as well as integrated into the utilization mechanisms for studies. We are looking at it from the perspective of life sciences, fundamental physics, and physical sciences, as well as how can we apply this information to the human research program, as well as to other divisions across NASA. We look at our work for lunar research in a very integrated manner, from fundamental science to space technologies, Earth benefits, as well as human exploration. So what we're interested in doing is really taking what we learn from a fundamental perspective and being able to translate and apply that to many different areas that will enable advancement of human exploration on the moon for sustainability as well as beyond for Mars. Also, we'd like to advance and build our communities around lunar science, as well as inspire and educate and train our next generation of engineers and scientists, operations people, who are really going to be the ones that take us beyond the moon and to Mars. Now, when I do say this, it's not necessarily that we are going to forget about the International Space Station. When I also talk about an integrated lunar science research, BPS is looking at it from the perspective of both Earth-based analogs to LEO work on ISS and other low Earth orbit platforms and all the way out towards the moon. And how do we use each of those platforms in order to really understand biology and physical sciences and fundamental physics as it applies to going outside of low Earth orbit. So we're not leaving anything away. We are going to become inclusive, again, of all the work that we have done and applying it out towards the moon. So there are multiple ways to conduct science in the lunar environment, and the BPS division is certainly going to take advantage of opportunities to put research on every single vehicle that we can. This is a whole new area, and it's an area that our scientists have been really excited about doing, to be able to actually do research in the true radiation environment of deep space, as well as to understand partial gravity and physical sciences and life science responses alone and in combination with the space environment. So we will be looking to do research on other areas. And as part of that, and as part of being part of SMD, we are being integrated into all of the efforts that are currently going on in NASA in order to understand what are the objectives for utilization, scientific utilization on these platforms and at the moon and around the moon in cislunar orbit, and also how we can bring our science to all sorts of different areas in for what we are interested in looking at.